If you would, open your Bibles to Exodus chapter 19. Exodus chapter 19. And as you're turning there, I want to read a brief little passage that I think could serve as a good introduction to our lesson from Romans chapter 5. So turn to Exodus chapter 19, and we're going to look at Romans chapter 5. Romans chapter 5 and verse 6 says, "While we were still helpless, at the right time, Christ died for the ungodly." Verse 8 says, "But God demonstrates his own love towards us, in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us." And then verse 10 says, "For if, while we were enemies, we were reconciled to God through the death of his Son, much more, having now been reconciled, we shall be saved by his life." I want you to notice a couple of things from those passages that I just read. One of them is the description that's used of Christians at the time that Christ died, or of people who would become Christians. It says, when Jesus died for us, we were helpless, we were ungodly, we were sinners, and we were enemies. Those are four descriptions that are used of the people for whom Jesus died, of people who are now Christians. You were helpless, ungodly, sinner, and enemy. But the other thing I want you to notice, and I think it's really important to understanding Paul's main point here, is how much of the language in those passages deals with time. What I mean by that is the timing of the event is what's so critical, and the timing of the event is what's so crucial. He didn't wait until we've already put in, you know, a good 100 hours of worship service before Jesus found us worthy to die for us. Jesus didn't wait until we had fed the poor and helped those who were in need before he thought we were worthy to die for. Jesus didn't wait until we had read our Bible through and memorized 100 verses and all. He didn't wait for us to start proving righteousness before he died for us. It was while we were enemies. It was at the time we were sinners and helpless and ungodly. That's when Jesus died for us. What that means is the death of Jesus is completely, wholly, and entirely an act of God's grace. It is completely, wholly, and entirely a gift that God gave to us before we did anything ever for him. God went through that which was necessary to make the offer to us available, and then he presented it to us, not based on any deeds which we had done in righteousness, not based on how good we were or how much we could accomplish for him or how much he owed us or anything like that. It was unmerited, unearned, undeserved gift, love, grace, goodness from God in the death of Jesus. He gave the most monumental gift you could possibly give, that of his firstborn son, that of his only and unique son, so that we could have the opportunity to be his, even though we were sinners, even though we were helpless and ungodly, even though we were enemies. You know, the Bible calls us to love our enemy. There's no greater example of that than God himself and what he did for us. Now, with that in mind, I want us to think about Exodus 19 a little bit. Because when you get to Exodus chapter 19, the children of Israel arrive at Sinai. And we know Mount Sinai is this monumental moment where that's where they get the law of Moses, right? And that's where they start receiving the laws, and that's where they enter into their covenant with God and all of that stuff. They look back to Sinai. But think about what God has done for the children of Israel up to this point. I mean, just kind of going through the book of Exodus, they were in slavery, and he heard them and loved them and cared about them. And so with a mighty arm and a powerful hand, he delivered them from Egyptian slavery. He did so with 10 plagues. He did so by turning the world upside down and showing that in weakness they are made strong, and those who believe they are strong are in fact the weakest. And he delivered them from Egyptian slavery. When the Red Sea became an obstacle, he split it in half so that they could walk through on dry ground. All of that is what Christ, what God did for us in Jesus, or in what God did for the children of Israel as they were leaving Exodus. They get into the wilderness, and it's like as soon as they get there, they begin complaining against him. They begin murmuring and grumbling. They complain about the food situation. They complain about the water situation. And what's fascinating is God doesn't, in this passage, rebuke them for that. Do you know what he does when they complain about the food? He gives them manna. You know what God does when they complain about the water? He gives them water multiple times. One time he turns bitter water fresh, and one time he gets water actually from a rock for them. All of these things are magnificent ways that God is providing and demonstrating his provision for them. It's like he didn't have them walk to a river or something. He showed that water comes from a rock when God is on your side. He didn't make, you know, a market appear and people could go purchase bread. He just dropped it out of the heavens. That's the type of stuff that happens when God provides for you. And then they actually, you keep reading, they end up getting into this battle. And during this battle, they apparently are not strong enough to win it. And so God is going to give them the victory in this battle. And he does so in, again, a miraculous way. He has Moses lifting up his staff. And as long as it's in the air, they'll win the battle. But as long as it starts going down, then they'll lose the battle. And what's fascinating is not only are they not strong enough to win the battle on their own, Moses isn't even strong enough to hold his arm up on his own. So he needs like help to hold his arm up so that they could win this battle and so that God could give them this great victory. It's like all of that's taking place where God is giving them victory over their enemies, freedom from slavery, power even over the Egyptians, food from heaven, water from rocks. All of that is this gift from God. And what has he required of them thus far? Virtually nothing. He hasn't even given them like the law yet. He's just seen a people who were helpless and who were sinners and who were ungodly. And he reached out to them in love and he saved them and he brought them from Egypt and he brought them from bondage and he's giving them something incredible. What he's giving them is the opportunity to be their own people, to be an autonomous people, to be his people, to be people who will be something for the whole rest of the world. When you get to Exodus chapter 19, you get this description of this is what God's wanting the children of Israel to be. Like, I think a couple of things, sometimes we don't emphasize perhaps like we should. I think sometimes there's confusion about what Israel was all about. What I mean by that is you have the children of Israel. It's like you have this whole Old Testament story about these people. But what were they doing? Like when we tell the story of the gospel, a lot of times it's like God made this beautiful garden, people sinned, we needed something to solve this problem of sin, so you fast forward to Jesus, Jesus solves the problem of sin, and then we can go to heaven. And that's kind of our brief story. And all of a sudden there's like the whole story of Israel, which is the majority of the Bible, is just left out of that because it's kind of like, what was their purpose? Were they just something to delay time until Jesus got here? Was it just a waiting game or what was their purpose? I think Exodus 19 helps give us what this whole purpose, what their role in the story is. What is the purpose of the story of Israel? And it's because God, from the beginning, had more than just Israel in mind. God, from the beginning, had the whole world in mind when he created it and when he planned to redeem it. So I want to read a couple of verses with you from Exodus chapter 19. Verse 3 is where we'll begin. But they arrive at Sinai, they start camping around the mountain, and verse 3 says, Moses went up to the mountain, and the Lord called to him from the mountain, saying, Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob, and tell the sons of Israel, You yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians. So he reminds them of the past, of the Exodus. You've seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. They didn't escape on their own. They were carried there on eagle's wings, God describes it as. Like, this is just a gift of freedom that God gave them. Verse 5, he says, Now then, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my commandments and my covenant, then you shall be my own possession among all the peoples, for all the earth is mine. Notice God loves all the earth. All the earth belongs to him, but he's doing something unique with Israel. He's saying, I saved you, I delivered you, I bore you on eagle's wings, I brought you to myself, and I'm going to give you the opportunity here to be my own special people among all the peoples of the earth. I'm going to give you the opportunity to obey a covenant, to obey the things that I say. And if you do that, there will be something unique and different about you than everybody else in the whole wide world. And so it is conditional in verse 5, and that's kind of fascinating. That verse 5, he's saying, I saved you, and it was not conditional. It's like, I saved you and I brought you out of there and you had done nothing. You had met no conditions. Like you just were given this, but I'm giving you the opportunity now to enter into something. And if you, should you so choose to accept it, you'll be different than the whole rest of the world. Verse 6, this is what they will be to the whole rest of the world. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. And these are the words that you shall speak to the sons of Israel. So he says, this is what you'll be. You'll be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. That's a fascinating idea. The idea of being a kingdom of priests. Because we know that there was like a priesthood. You have the Levitical priesthood. You have the sons of Aaron who become high priests. Like, you have that whole system right there. But what he's offering them is to be a kingdom of priests. It's like the entire kingdom has this role to serve as a priest. You think, well, who are they the priests for? Well, I think the idea that he's getting at here, and it's really the idea that connects Israel to the whole grand story of the Bible, is that their purpose is for the whole rest of the world. The whole rest of the world is going to have learn of God, have access to God through the children of Israel. The children of Israel are how God is going to bring about his saving work to the whole rest of the world. So it's like, you go back to Genesis, you go back to the Garden of Eden, you have this beautiful, blissful, peaceful garden. Sin enters, curse enters, pain, sin, death, all that stuff enters, and God starts working on a plan. The humans end up like going haywire, and it's like it starts with this one bad decision in Eden, and then it very quickly turns into murder, and then it turns into all kinds of murderous things, and then it turns into nonstop violence and wickedness, and every thought of the intention of man's heart was only evil continually. And so what God decides to do is restart creation. If you read Genesis 1 and verse 2, it says, after saying in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, it describes it. It says, the earth was formless and void. There was darkness over the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. And it's like you get this image of this dark, watery existence, right? What happens in the flood? It's like a return to that dark water. It's an uncreation going back to Genesis 1-2, and then a recreation where the flood waters go down, the land appears again, the animals come off, and he repopulates the land. God restarts creation. The book of 2 Peter chapter 3 describes the heavens and the earth that existed long ago, meaning pre-flood. Now we have a present heavens and earth that we are living in. That's post-flood. It's like a new heavens and a new earth started. And God has new plans for this heavens and earth. But what happens? Well, you have Noah. Noah gets off the boat, and guess what he does? Pretty much the same thing Adam did. Adam disobeyed God. He ended up naked and ashamed. He ended up misusing the plants that were there. Noah gets off the flood, grows a vineyard, then gets drunk on it, and then gets naked on it. And then after kind of an odd ordeal with his sons, there's curses and there's blessings that come again, just like with the story of Adam. So it's like God recreated the world, and mankind recreated the same sin. And just like it continued to spread and went haywire with Cain and his sons and all that story up until the flood, the next story you get is Babel, the Tower of Babel, where the children, or where humanity comes together for their own pride and in their own stand for their own name rather than the name of God. And they end up getting spread throughout the whole world, and they bring their evil and wickedness with them. And all of a sudden, again, you have the story of like all creation being filled with sin and violence and wickedness. And so what God does this time, he doesn't flood the whole world again. He made a whole covenant saying he's not going to do that. Instead, what he does is he chooses one man and one family and says, I'm going to bring blessing back into this world, and I'm going to do so through you and through your descendants. He chooses Abraham. He shows Abraham this land that he's going to give him. He says, Abraham, through you, the whole world will be blessed again. All the nations of the earth will be blessed. And so like, all the way from the beginning, the plan has been to bless all mankind. God has loved all mankind. You see, throughout the Old Testament even, God's concern isn't only for Israel. God's concern is for all mankind. And the purpose of Israel is to be this holy nation, this kingdom of priests, on behalf of all mankind. The purpose of Israel is to show the world the goodness and the glory and the wisdom and the righteousness and the justice of God. And so Exodus 19, he calls them to Sinai, and he's saying, I'm giving you a chance right now to be something different, to be something that, you saw Egypt, right? You saw how much murder was there, and you saw how much wickedness. You saw that they made people, like, they oppressed people horribly. They treated you horribly because you were strangers and all that. What if there was a nation that wasn't like that? You saw Babel, right? You go through the story of the Old Testament. You see Babel. You see Sodom and Gomorrah. You see Egypt. Like, look at every city you've seen so far. Look at the city that Cain started. Like, look at every city you've seen. It's been full of wickedness and violence and terror. What God is saying is, Israel, you can be something different. Right now, I saved you. I brought you out of slavery. I'm giving you the land. You be something different. And you show the rest of the world how to live. You show my name and my goodness to the rest of the world. And did you know that's actually what Torah is all about? That's what the law, or the instruction of God, that we call the first five books of the Old Testament the law, right? We call it the law of Moses. And there's a reason we do that. That comes to be what it's called. So it's fair to do that. But sometimes that can lead us into thinking that the entire thing is just like laws. It's not until Exodus 20 that you start getting these laws. It's like up to this point, you've seen God's patience and his grace and his gifts, but you haven't really seen him give a lot of laws yet. It's in Exodus 20 there at Sinai, after he says, you can be a kingdom of priests, a royal nation, people of my own possession, and here's how you do that. And he starts explaining what that looks like. And it looks like the Ten Commandments. Sole commitment to God, not making any other gods, taking God's name, bearing it with honor, not profaning or saying it in vain. It deals with things like Sabbath observance. Sabbath observance, they didn't get Sabbath in Egypt. You know, in Egypt, they were worked to the bone all day, every day, because they were slaves that no one cared for. What the children of Israel are told are, I don't care whether you're a king, whether you're a working class individual, whether you're a slave, or whether you're a donkey, everyone gets Sabbath. And that's really true. Like, even the animals get Sabbath when you read the Sabbath laws. Even the land gets Sabbath. What God is saying is, I want you to remember slavery, and I want you to be a land that gives everybody rest. I want you to be a land that's different. I want you to be a land where you do not kill, where you do not steal, where you do not commit adultery. You start going through the laws, and you realize that by comparing these laws to what we've seen from every city we've run into so far, or every kingdom or every nation, Israel's being called to stand out and to be different, a holy nation that is set apart from all the other nations. If you look at Exodus chapter 20 through 23, that's the first law code that we really get in the Bible. It's this like four chapter description of what the laws of God are to look like. And they cover a bunch of topics. They cover things like Sabbath. They cover feast days. They cover what altars are supposed to look like. They cover property rights. They cover like a ton of different topics in this first Israelite law code. But I want to read just a couple of them to you. Look with me at Exodus chapter 23. And compare this to the way that the nations around Israel behaved. Exodus chapter 23, we'll start just in verse 4. He says, if you meet an enemy's ox or his donkey wandering away, you shall surely return it to him. You know what that means? That means if you're walking down the road and you see that your neighbor who you hate and he hates you and his ox is torn down the fence and he's out wandering away, you don't go, ha, 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 and carry on. It means you say, man, now I have work to do and I have to go help my enemy even though he's not a nice guy or whatever. It's like you have a responsibility to your fellow Israelites, whether you like him or not. You show love for even your enemies. That kind of sounds like some of the stuff Jesus says, by the way. It's almost like he was raised hearing Torah. But you show love and kindness and service even to your enemies. He says in verse 5, if you see the donkey of one who hates you lying helpless under its load, you shall refrain from leaving it to him. You shall surely release it with him. If you see this donkey and he can't even carry the load, go help it out, even if the guy who owns it hates you. That's the type of love I want people to see in Israel. He says in verse 6, you shall not pervert injustice due to the needy brother in his dispute. Keep far from a false charge. Do not kill the innocent or the righteous, for I will not acquit the guilty. And you shall not take a bribe, for bribes blind the clear-sighted and subverts the cause of the just. You shall not oppress the stranger. Why? Why don't oppress the stranger? Since you yourselves know the feeling of a stranger, for you also were strangers in the land of Egypt. So he says, like, learn from Egypt and don't be like them. Be different. You know what it's like to be a stranger, so treat strangers well. You know what it's like to be oppressed, so help the oppressed. Love your enemies. Like, all of these laws that are given are ways of elevating Israel so that people can see the goodness and the love of God, to see the wisdom of God, to see the power of God among these people. And you know what happens when these people who are called by the name of God, the unique God, they are the people who are the people of Yahweh. You know what happens when they don't follow these and when they act like everyone else? this whole mission that he gives them, it just falls flat. And it just piddles into nothing. Like, God says, you can be, I want to bring blessing to the whole rest of the world, and I want you to be the priests of the world. I want you to be the ones who represent me to the whole rest of the world. I want you to be the ones who show and instruct the rest of the world what life with God is all about. And so you live in this way, and they say, oh, okay, but first let me go start worshiping other gods. Well, if you do that, then the rest of the world doesn't learn about Yahweh, do they? If you worship all the other gods of the rest of the world, like, it's just, his name becomes muddled and people don't learn anything special about him. Or if you just ignore his commands and you act like the rest of the world and you don't love your enemy and you don't show goodness and you do have injustice and bribery in your social justice system and all of that, like, if you have all that taking place, then you also fail at this mission. And so Israel's mission only works if they follow the instruction and Torah of God, and if they solely commit themselves to the Lord. If they do that, though, there's a powerful purpose behind Israel. The problem is that they so often fail at being this unique people. The problem is that, like, the whole story of the rest of the Old Testament is how regularly they look just like everybody else. But God's giving them the chance right here, before they ever did anything righteous, to be his special people, to have this Torah that will separate them from everyone else, where they can have this elevated status, where they show the rest of the world what God is all about. And then after giving them this law, in Exodus chapter 24, he gives them the chance to accept it. They've already been freed. They've already been brought to Sinai. They were told he'll give you this perfect special mission. You'll be a kingdom unlike any other. You'll be a kingdom of priests. You'll be a holy nation. You'll be my own special possession. You'll be unlike anyone that you've ever seen before. You'll be unlike the people who have ruled you before. You can show the rest of the world how to do it. You can be the light of the world. You can be a city set on a hill. You can be the salt of the earth. Those aren't the exact words that he uses, although light of the world gets pretty close to some language for Israel. But that's kind of what they're being called to be. And you can perhaps see, as Christians, we have a similar vocation, right? We're supposed to show people how to live in this world. We're supposed to be the city on the hill that shows all of the other cities how to do justice and love right. And it shows all the other cities what Jesus is all about. But if we fall into the trap of putting our hope in the same things that the rest of the world puts their hope in, then Jesus isn't going to be glorified in that. And if we fall into the same trap of responding to our enemies and responding to other people the way the rest of the world does, then again, we fall into the same trap of not actually fulfilling our vocation and purpose and mission. And so you're supposed to stand out. Israel was supposed to stand out. And Torah is how they stood out. For us, I think, perhaps even more so than Torah, or definitely more so than Torah, is Jesus himself is our identity marker, is how we stand out. We stand out because we wear the name of Jesus, and we live in the example and in the humility and in the love of Jesus. But just like we have a choice as to whether or not we enter into that mission, so too did Israel. When you get to chapter 24, I want to read something really quickly before we read chapter 24. In verse 19, in chapter 19, right after Moses is told that this is what you're going to be, this holy nation and all that stuff, this royal priesthood, he says in verse 8, all the people answered together and said, all that the Lord has spoken, we will do. So they say, that sounds great to us. This Lord just conquered Pharaoh. I want to be on his team. And so they say, yes, absolutely, we'll do that. Keep that in mind, because that's kind of going to bookend with what happens in chapter 24. 19 through 24 is a story there at Sinai. They're told what they're going to be. They're told what the law looks like. And then chapter 24 is their opportunity to accept it or reject it. Chapter 24, Moses, it's been on the mountain. Verse 3, it says, Moses came, and then he recounted to the people all the words of the Lord and all the ordinances. So, like, all those laws we just talked about, Moses recounts them to the people now. And all the people with one voice answered and said, all the words which the Lord has spoken, we will do. All right, that's the same promise they made back in chapter 19. So it's like, everything the Lord has spoken, we will do, we will be obedient, we'll enter into this, you can count on us, you know, we're going to do it. And so they say they want to enter into this covenant with God. So Moses then wrote down all the words of the Lord, which is one of the earliest references to the writing of the Bible in the Bible, where it says Moses wrote down all the words of the Lord. He arose early in the morning. They end up going through this ritual where they enter into this covenant. They slice the necks of some bulls. They gather some blood. They put it in a bowl. He throws it on the altar. But then also, verse 7, it says, he took the book of the covenant, and he read it in the hearing of the people, and they said, all that the Lord has spoken, we will do, and we will be obedient. So Moses took the blood, and he sprinkled it on the people, and said, behold, the blood of the covenant, which the Lord made with you in accordance with all of these words. And so there's this covenant, and it's finally enacted. It becomes a legit, both parties agree to it. This is like a legally binding agreement that they have where God freed them. And he says, I'll be your God forever, but I want you to show people what I'm really like. This is what life looks like. That's what Torah is. This is what life looks like when you're living the way God wants you to live. It'll be different and separate from all the nations around you, but it'll be an example of who God really and truly is. And the people say, yes, we'll do it. So the blood is then thrown on the altar. It's thrown on the book that they all just agreed to follow, and it's thrown on the people themselves. And they enter into this agreement with God. They're going to be different. What is the foundation of this agreement with God? Sometimes we, I think, can think of the law of Moses as, oh, God just made a whole bunch of rules. It was terrible. It was horribly oppressive. The people, you know, floundered under the weight of the law. No one could keep it. And so it was like this miserably difficult, overbearing burden on the people. Like sometimes we can view Torah or the law of Moses as there were 613 different laws. That's so much. And like all of that, I think that's probably a wrong way to think about the law of Moses. I think a better way to think about the law of Moses is God gave them a gift of wisdom and of life, and they could live it out in such a way that the rest of the world would learn good things about God through them and through their actions. It's like, it wasn't a bad thing that they were given this law. This was a special gift that was made them separate and unique and special to God among all the people. This is the code of how to live and learn and love in the land of God. And so you see all of that taking place, and the people enter into it. They enter into this covenant. They get this good law that, I mean, when you read the Psalms, they're always praising this law that God gave them. The law is ultimately a good thing, but like we said, they struggled to keep it. If they did keep it, I think they would have looked different than everyone else. But so often they wanted to look like the nations around them. I want to read a couple of passages in the New Testament before we draw our lesson to a close. One of them is in 1 Peter. 1 Peter chapter 2. 1 Peter chapter 2, you come across an early Christian community surrounded by people who think and believe and act and worship and behave differently than they do. They are not Christians. They are strangers in this environment because they have a different king than everyone else. Everyone else has Caesar. They have the Lord Jesus Christ. And so they look different. They sound different. And people are very suspicious of them. People tend to get suspicious of strangers, foreigners, and exiles. And so the early Christians like found themselves as a community that everyone was suspicious of. They said bad things about them. They slandered them. They said, you know, these people, they don't even like, and they would talk about them. All of this stuff was going on, and they're trying to learn, how do I handle persecution when the world hates us? And how do I show the world that there's actually something good in what we're doing here? How do we stand out? How do we show that this isn't some sort of insurrectionist or bad thing, but this is actually something that could be a light to the whole rest of the world? So you look at chapter 2, and that's what Peter's trying to encourage them to do. This is how you live as a Christian in a land that is pre-Christian, or I would say post-Christian, a land where Christianity is not the culture and is not the normal way that people think. He says in verse 4, "And coming to him," talking about God, "as a living stone which has been rejected by men, but choice and precious in the sight of God." That kind of reminds me of the children of Israel, by the way, who were rejected by men, like in slavery, but God chose them and they were precious to him. And he delivered them. You look a little bit further in verse 9. We'll go back to verse 5. He says, "You also," talking about to the Christians, "as living stones are being built up to a spiritual house for a holy priesthood to offer up spiritual sacrifices to God through Jesus Christ. And so they themselves, early Christians themselves, are supposed to take on this role of priesthood. Again, priest for who? I think we're supposed to be showing the rest of the world who God is and what he is all about. And we offer up spiritual sacrifices to God, but we don't do it through Torah. We offer spiritual sacrifices to God through Jesus Christ. Look at verse 9. But you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession. Do you know where all those descriptions come from? Exodus 19, the passage that we started with when he's talking about Israel. He's saying, you guys are what you were, what Israel was called to be. You're continuing to carry that mantra and carry that with you. He says, you are these things, verse 9 continues, that you proclaim the excellences of he who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. So they were called from darkness into light. Israel was supposed to be a light to the nations. They were called from slavery into freedom. I think you have a very similar type of story being told here about the Christians in darkness who are being called from that to be the special people, this royal nation, this chosen holy priesthood, people who are special to God and the whole world. And then verse 11, he says, beloved, I urge you, as aliens and strangers. That's kind of like Israel, who are aliens and strangers. As aliens or foreigners and strangers, to abstain from the fleshly lusts which wage war against the soul, and to keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles, so that in the thing in which they slander you as evildoers, they may, because of your good deeds as they observe them, glorify God in the day of visitation. Those people who are suspicious and skeptical, those people who don't fully understand what you're doing as a Christian, you live in such a way that in the day of visitation, that when the ultimate day comes, they may be found to be people who glorify God. Perhaps you can change the world by your behavior. And the way that he goes on to describe that in the rest of chapter 2 is through imitation of Jesus and through submission and humility. When you show a life of submission and love of others, when while being reviled, you do not revile in return, and while suffering, you utter no threats, when you follow the example of Jesus, you'll end up looking different. And when you end up looking different, people see Jesus in you. And that's one of our primary vocations and tasks on this earth. It's very similar to what Israel was called to do. The same language is used for what we are called to do. But we have the choice. Just like the children of Israel were asked, do you want to enter into this covenant? And they said, we do all that the Lord has spoken we will do. We have a covenant as well. Hebrews chapter 9 describes the death of Jesus as the blood of the covenant that we enter into, borrowing the same language and the same discussion from Exodus chapter 24. When Jesus is instituting the Lord's Supper, he uses that same language also when he talks about this is the blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins. The blood of the covenant, which we're about to partake of here in just a moment, is this reminder of this pledge that we entered into with God, of this agreement that we have with God through Jesus, that we would be his people, his own special people, that we would be people separate and apart who would show the rest of the world what justice, goodness, wisdom, mercy, and love are really all about. We would show the world who God really is. So here's the challenge as we bring our lesson to a close. Number one, rejoice in the grace of God because he gave a gift to you before you ever did anything to in any way merit or deserve it. In fact, you've never done anything that could even begin to merit or deserve what God has done for you. Rejoice in the grace of God. And because of that, take seriously his call to be a light in the world, his call to live differently than the rest of the world, to put your hope and your actions into something different than the rest of the world does. And as we take the Lord's Supper here in just a moment, remember and renew that covenant that you made to do that, to rejoice in the grace of God and to live differently because of it, because he's calling you to be something special and unique. And as you take the Lord's Supper here, it's a reminder of that blood of the covenant. It's a weekly reminder that we engage in. Just like the children of Israel entered into that covenant, we have entered into the covenant. Just like they had the blood of the covenant, we have the blood of the covenant. And we remember Jesus week in and week out in our commitment to him. And if there's anyone here who wants to enter into this task, to this mission that God has set for us, we'd love to welcome you with open arms. We'd love to welcome you as a brother or sister. If you want to name Jesus as Lord of your life, confess him, have your sins washed away in baptism, and live for him from this day forward. We pray that you would let that be known either here or you can talk to one of the elders in the back. If you have a need, please let it be known while we stand and as we sing.